Welcome to Running on Indy. I'm Jesse Davis.
And I'm Blake Robertson.
On today's episode, we're going to have Dr. Christopher Carr from St. Vincent Sports Performance, who's going to talk to us about sports psychology and how to get that mental edge.
This episode of Running on Indy is brought to you by 361 Degrees Running Shoes, the all-new Sensation 3 and Stability High Mileage Trainer, powered by QuickFoam. Check out the all-new 361 Sensation 3, and you can find it at the Runners Forum downtown in Indianapolis or at your local retailer or specialty store.
Awesome. Thanks, Blake. Hey, Dr. Carr, just to get started off, can you tell us a little bit about what you do? Because I was asking people if they had any questions for the sports psychologist we're having on, and some people were actually like, what is a sports psychologist? I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah. Well, I've been asked this question a lot. First of all, I think any distance runner probably needs to see a psychologist.
Oh, yeah.
In my career working with ultra endurathon, professional triathletes, collegiate track and distance athletes, my background is I played college football and thought I was going to go into coaching, did a master's degree in counseling psychology, ended up working for 4 years with adolescents who had substance abuse issues. But I never lost my love of sport and had some friends tell me about sports psychology, and I started researching it a little bit, and I found that most people calling themselves sports psychologists were either not psychologists, they had training in physical education, kinesiology, or they were a psychologist that reads sports page and wants to hang out with athletes. So I kind of made the decision to go back. My PhD is in counseling psychology, so I'm actually a licensed psychologist. I did that at Ball State. And then I did a minor in sport and exercise psychology through the School of Physical Education, and spent the third year of my doctoral work as a clinical research assistant in sports psychology at the U.S. Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. And that was awesome. It was a year of working with elite high-level athletes, and then was fortunate when I finished my degree to be hired at Washington State University in their athletics department. And really, for the past 28, 29 years, I've worked primarily in collegiate athletics. I spent 10 years with the U.S. Alpine ski team, 3 Olympics. I worked with the U.S. diving team prior to the Beijing Olympics. And then currently at St. Vincent Sports Performance, I coordinate the sports psychology program, and we take care of Purdue's athletic department, Butler University athletics. And then I just finished my 7th year with the Indiana Pacers as their team psychologist. So, you know, for the past 30 years, really, I've kind of worked as a counseling sports psychologist in the realm of elite athlete participation. So obviously part of that is working with distance athletes, whether they be triathletes, marathon, half marathon runners at all different levels. So that's my background, but I'm not going to claim to do any running at all whatsoever. I used to have a really negative attitude in college football that I had to do a mile run for time, wondering why would an offensive lineman ever have to run a mile at all. Of course, I didn't understand the physiology of fitness and exercise, but I can say I've done one sprint triathlon in my life, and I accomplished my goal. That was to finish. So this community is unique because every once in a while in my practice or in the collegiate setting, I'm working with distance athletes to help them with the mental side of competition and training.
Yeah. And you said like you recommended like most or to all distance runners need to see somebody. Are you saying that we're crazy?
Well, I didn't say that. You guys said that on the podcast. No, you know what I think so unique is and what I really enjoy about working with distance athletes, and I think rarely reference to runners, to distance swimmers. I worked with open water swimmers. Is really the management of pain and discomfort as part of elite performance. And the training loads that are expected, the dealing with injury issues that are expected. I try to simplify when people say, what is sports psychology? you know, the way I see it is I'm helping with three areas of an athlete's development. That's confidence, composure, and concentration issues. And the fourth piece the athlete controls, and that's a commitment to the plan. Anyone can say, I want to run the mini or I want to run Boston, but what kind of plan are you committing to get your training so that it allows you to get the times and perform at the level you want to perform? And there's a mental component to that that sports psychologists have.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Carr, Blake here. And just for the audience knows, we're this is our first Skype. So we are, Dr. Carr is Skyping us. So we're honored to have him here. Also, you're probably our most badass guest we've actually had on so far this year. So that's pretty awesome. Your resume is very phenomenal. I guess my question would be for you, how much of long-distance running success do you think is mental versus physical?
Well, it's interesting. If I were to speak to a group of elite athletes or even when I go into training camp with the Pacers, typically I'll ask three questions. The first one being from 0 to 100%, how much of your sport is mental? And that's a rhetorical question. There's no real data that indicates it's this. You know, the old Yogi Berra quote that 90% of baseball is 50% mental or something like that. but typically I'll ask athletes, how much of your sport is mental, meaning it deals with confidence, your ability to manage your nerves, your composure skills, and your ability to focus on the right thing at the right time. And most athletes at the elite level will say anywhere from 60, 70, 80%. The second question I ask is, of all the times you have poor performance or make mistakes, what percentage of those are mental? And so, for example, if you are a sub 50 runner in a distance event, but you at important meets are running 56, 58, and you can't break that PR, even though your conditioning and fitness is well, you can't say you don't have the physical abilities. But for some reason, you're not executing at the level you want to execute, probably due to an attentional issue, and managing the nerves. And typically most elite athletes, when I ask that question, say 90% or more of their mistakes are mental, which leads to the third question: of all the time you spend in training and preparing, what percent do you spend doing mental training? USOC many years ago did a brief survey. US athletes that medal at the Olympic Games spend an average of about 25 to 30 minutes a day doing mental training. So when I work with an athlete, what we're trying to do is give them a strategic plan to work on those issues that totals about 30 minutes a day of actual committed time to your mental preparation. And so the answer to how much of it is mental is really dependent on that athlete themselves. You know, when you talk about the elite level athletes that are competing at the highest level, I mean, we're talking seconds that differentiate in performance. But at the same level for that recreational runner or that person who's doing running for fitness or maybe trying their first mini, do they know the goals that they realistically want to accomplish, and how are they going to manage that race environment on race day?
Yeah, I feel like I don't put enough into the mental side now that you just said that.
I don't. I'm a complete head case. I'd say that straight up.
Yeah. that's a fantastic answer. So how do you think distance running compares, the challenges of distance running compared to like some of the other sports you do?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'll be asked a question. Someone will say, well, golf is really mental, or if you do a certain kind of sport, there's a mental component. To me, every athlete in any sport has a mental component. So when I work with an NBA team, every player on that court can benefit from mental skills. So I think the reality is in distance events, running, for example, the monotony of the training, the pain and the discomfort that's involved in the training, the ability to handle injuries or setbacks. Let's say you get a really good plan and you're doing really good in your training cycle and then start to develop some arch issues or you have some stress responses. You know, what's common to me is an athlete that says, the way I manage my stress as a runner is I run. And if I can't run, how do I manage my stress? Or an athlete who has great training and they feel really good in their training group and then they go to a 5K or they go to a half marathon and they just perform horribly. And they say, I just couldn't sleep the night before. I was really anxious. I stepped to the start and I felt like I'd already run half the race. And they're not controlling the butterflies. We don't want to get rid of butterflies. We want to teach them how to fly in formation. And you've got to use that arousal that's a part of performance. So when you look at sports, and I've worked with sports from shooting sports to team sports to individual performance sports, downhill skiers that click into skis and go 70 miles an hour down a mountain and win races by 4/100ths of a second. Tommy Moe, in 1994 Olympic Games, the first Olympic gold medalist that I had the real pleasure and privilege to work with, Tommy won his gold medal in the Lillehammer downhill by 0.004 seconds. And when you're talking about competing at an elite level or trying to establish PRs and set personal records, if you don't have a good mental plan, it's those other things that may distract you from that kind of performance. And also in my experience, you know, 30 years, runners by nature tend to be somewhat perfectionistic. They get very organized and structured. They get very ritualistic in their planning. And so you have to create mental routines that help that individual really optimize any training run, any recovery day, anything they do ancillarily to training. That's what you're trying to do.
Yeah. And I have a follow-up to that because I know a lot of runners that are they're super type A. I'm not particularly like that, but I know a lot of people that are, that if something, they get a setback, that they just can't get over it, whether in the race or in their training. Like, say they lost a week or they had to change something up that they didn't want to, like they had to go lighter or whatever, some kind of mental, physical setback, and they just can't recoup because it just the plan didn't go perfect. What are some good strategies for dealing with that? Because, I mean, sometimes, I mean, I think actually I've been running for almost all my life, and I don't think I've ever had a perfect training cycle where everything went right. So how can people cope with that when they get those setbacks?
Well, I think the answer to really the specific aspect of dealing with injury or dealing with training setbacks, it really relates to how good of a mental plan do you practice on a daily basis. If you're a runner and you have some type of setback due to an IT band issue or something that's really kind of putting a setback, you have to be able to have positive self-talk that allows you to kind of refocus. You have to have good goal-setting skills so that your rehab and your work with your PT or your chiropractor, your massage therapist is very goal-directed. You have to use visualization and imagery as part of your racing routine or your training routine so that, you know, instead of going out and doing a long run on a day, maybe that day you're going to visualize the middle segment of your run or the final 500 meters of your run. And you become very proactive at a subconscious level so that you're not allowing the doubts and the fears and the anxiety to build up. So it's really having a mental toolbox that allows you to accept, A, that if you're going to put this pressure and stress on your body, then there's a high likelihood that you might have some setbacks. And I think a lot of times what type A's do is they look at the top of the mountain as a comparison instead of maybe where they're at more realistically in their own training load. And I, you know, what's fascinating for me in my work individually with athletes, I'm a real advocate in journaling and self-awareness. And so when I have runners come in, they often say, well, do you mean like a training journal? Because they're very good at writing down their training sessions, their times, their splits. You know, the way, no, I'm talking about just, was today a good day? Was today a bad day? What made it good? What made it bad? What's your motivation level? What are your anxieties or fears as you approach a race? Those are the types of things that you're trying to get awareness of, because you can't disconnect your thoughts, your feelings, and your behaviors from your performance. So you learn how to manage that.
Dr. Carr, and you may have touched on this a little bit, but what are some common pitfalls do you see that distance athletes hinder in their performance?
Yeah, like what are even if that's in a race or just in training, what is like some common things that just really can mess distance runners up? And you may have already touched on this a little bit, but
yeah, I think for runners that I've worked with over the many years, there's a couple of common kind of setbacks. Number one is the difference between training and competing. And the idea is that you get home from work one day, you just kind of throw on your shoes and your shorts and you go out and you run the Monon or something like that.
It's like
you don't really put a lot of, yeah, you don't put a lot of thought into it. Maybe you have distractions, so the running is actually a nice distraction, and you just kind of go out without expectations. You just go out to hit your mileage to do that. Then as you get closer to race day, you start incorporating all these ritualistic behaviors. And as you do that, what you actually do is you build the anxiety. Huh. The anxiety becomes fatiguing. You subconsciously know you're a little bit fatigued. You don't feel the same way that you felt when you did the Eagle Creek run. And now all of a sudden you're having a lot of anxiety and doubt. Am I going to be able to hit my goals, hit my time? And all of a sudden the race now becomes overwhelming. And I've had athletes that literally will have panic attacks, have severe anxiety, that are well-trained. Now, you know, if I went out to try to run a 5K, I'd have a legitimate panic attack because I haven't done it.
Yeah.
So I would have zero expectations. And if I have training and I know in my training that I'm ready to run the distance that I'm going to run, but I create my own doubts or hesitations and I don't have a mental plan for that, that becomes my pitfall. And in other words, what happens is athletes come to see me with one of the primary reasons is managing the anxiety of competition. I don't perform in races like I should be performing.
Yeah, does that sound like anybody, Blake?
Sounds like me. I'm going to tell on myself a little bit, and then I'm going to ask it with a question. So before a race, a major race, I get these massive, massive hacking coughs. I'm sure Jesse's heard it.
Oh, yeah. He sounds like a smoker.
It's like I'm dying. I don't know where it comes from. I wake up before a race and I'm doing it all the way up until the gun goes off. Once the gun goes off, it magically goes away. And I cannot control it. And it's just massive hacking. And so I guess that leads into my question. Are there mental techniques leading up to the race or right before the race that could help a distance athlete like myself to overcome these challenges?
Yeah. You know what you're talking about is really related to the fight or flight mechanism. It's a sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system. It's kind of our response. So when an athlete is getting ready to compete, there is, even if they're telling themselves they're ready, there is an internalized anxiety and anxiousness, because what do? You get to the race, you see everyone wearing their bibs, you see friends, you say, oh, that guy's fast, and you start wondering about how am I going to do today. Then what happens is you start to create cognitive anxiety, which triggers the physiological anxiety. So here's like some common things that I see. Athletes who go to the bathroom a lot because their GI system gets stressed, which then causes dehydration issues. The coughing is through this pulmonary response of a tightening in your lungs, in your chest, due to the increased arousal rate you're experiencing prior to a race. And it's kind of like if you get panicky or anxious, you notice that thinking about the anxiety makes it worse. And so you get this kind of anxiety stress spiral. And for some athletes, it can oftentimes be paralytic. So here's the key. One of the components when I start working with an athlete and we're doing specifically performance enhancement is I prescribe autogenic relaxation training. Now, I've got a 13-minute MP3 that I give to my clients and tell them to start practicing it 4 to 5 times a week. You can go on your phone and download a relaxation or a mindfulness app and make an intentional effort to start practicing relaxation. Because I'll come back and say, well, I can get easily relaxed because when I'm laying down getting ready to go to sleep, I'm not nervous. What I'm trying to do is teach you how to relax. So when you go to the race, you can incorporate deep breathing, you can use positive cues, you can actually get that anxiety to be more controlled and use it as energy in your race instead of a fatiguing, or in your instance, where you're getting that kind of uncontrollable pulmonary response. And to be honest, over the past 10 years, I've worked with a number of distance athletes who have what's called vocal cord dysfunction, And I don't know if you've heard about that in your community, but it's basically where the vocal cords shut down as a result of the anxiety, and now you can't breathe. And literally, I've had high school and collegiate cross country runners that pass out on the course, they run off the course because their vocal cords are doing all the anxious response to the nerves and the pre-performance anxiety. So it's anxiety management techniques that psychologists provide for people who have anxiety issues are very common to the same techniques sports psychologists use to help athletes get those butterflies to fly in formation.
And it's funny, Dr. Carr, because I'm pretty laid back dude, but when it comes to my running, I'm totally on the opposite end. Yeah. Especially in a large race, if you've been training for 6 to 8 months and you got this huge race coming up, then the one thing that goes crazy on me that I actually need the most of is my lungs.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
We also and also tying into that is also the situational variables. Because a lot of times when you have like a running group and it's a small group, it's a group you're comfortable with. It's a smaller number. We're going to go hit that trail. So all of our training is built on a different environment. Then you go to the race day and you have all the people and all of the extra distractions that you don't have in training. And so what I'll do oftentimes with athletes is give them pre-performance routines that they're going to use consistently in preparation in the big race moment. And that's where sports psychologists can help athletes develop those strategies to execute the performance they want to execute.
Yeah, that's incredible. I didn't even think that your hacking had anything to do with race anxiety. That's a great question. I didn't think so either.
Yes.
Well, now let me say that that's just a hypothesis.
But
this is not atypical at the same time.
Yeah.
It's not atypical that individuals that compete at the moment of competition or prior to a competition, some type of physiological response that's related to the pre-performance anxiety.
I got a question, like a personal question from on my end from how I deal with anxiety. Before a race, I actually, like I'm typically laid back myself, like in general, and I don't get where, and I probably should do a little more. I get out of the routine and I actually start getting way to the opposite end and way too laid back where like I'm not paying attention to the details I should be paying attention to. And that's how I deal with the anxiety, and which actually can be the detriment sometimes. Like, I mean, like getting to the line on time and paying attention to the details like that, or making sure you have the equipment and things like that. You know, have you ever heard of anything like that?
What you guys are both describing right now is kind of like sports psych 101. If I do a lecture to a team, one of the things we talk about is the inverted U hypothesis. Which basically, we all have to kind of pretend and visualize. If you can manage like an inverted U, like a bell-shaped curve, excuse me, in the middle of that bell-shaped curve, that arc is at the highest point. So if performance is on the left axis and your highest performance is at the top of that curve, that's kind of where you want your optimal arousal level to be, because the arousal is going from left to right. The arousal increases, gets higher, then it gets to an optimal level. And then as it continues to get higher, the performance starts to drop. Does that make sense? You guys following?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so what Blake is talking about is arousal that's on the right end of the continuum, where he's got such high arousal that his body is physiologically responding and his performance is dropping because of an increase in anxiety. What you're talking about is kind of being a little flat, little bit kind of less anxious. And so you're to the left side of that inverted U. The risk that you have is when you're at the left side and your arousal level is lower, you're more distractible. You don't focus on the right things because as that arousal increases, your focus narrows. It gets to the right place. And if you're over aroused, you focus on one thing and you miss something else. If you're under aroused, you see so many different things, it's hard to pick out what you need. So what you just described in saying, I'm trying to be laid back, it may hurt me because it may take me a little bit of time in my run to kind of get to that place that I need to be. And by that point, I may have had a bad start. And now I'm trying to compete with that. and I'm not at my optimal level.
Yeah.
And again, like you said, if you forgot something because you weren't kind of in that optimal place of your performance curve, and Yuri Hannon, who's a Russian, he's an Eastern European sports psychologist, he defined that as zones of optimal functioning. And the key for a distance athlete is to better understand his or her, what's their zone feel like? What do they think? What do they do when they're running their best tempo, their best time, their best pace, their best stride? It's like you want to find that recipe and then get yourself there at the gun.
Yeah. Well, that's incredible. That's really good advice.
Well, I'll use a Wizard of Oz quote. Great and powerful wizard, what do you have in your bag of tricks to help me get past this Star Wars genre that's now coming?
Oh, boy.
I can't get over that.
Blake always, if you ever listen to the podcast, Blake always says something about Star Wars. He does not like how the direction it's going. So.
How do I get past that?
You can hit the off button or change the channel.
That's what I'm doing.
Or yeah, don't go to the theater.
Yeah,
there's all kinds of refusal
yeah.
options.
Yeah, he is boycotting Han Solo. We talked about pre-race strategy, but once the race actually gets started, do you have any techniques? I can throw out, for example, for me, what's worked over the years, like in race, is breaking it up into segments and kind of compartmentalizing it, and like just like, hey, I gotta get to this point and then don't worry about anything after that, and then get to the next point and then so on and so forth, and not thinking of it as a whole but breaking it down. I don't know if what you think about that and versus like some other strategies, like once the race actually gets going, because once the race gets going, my nerves always seem to calm down and like I feel more comfortable then. It's just like leading up to it.
Yeah, what I work with distance athletes on are finding the process goals. In other words, the outcome goal is the time you want to run, whether it's a PR or to qualify for a big marathon or to qualify for an Olympic trial. Typically, a person has to have a certain time or finish a certain place in their age group. That's the outcome. What I try to help athletes do is find the process variables. So in distance running, for example, it's kind of like, I like to break distance events into the first and the middle and the end. And then the idea is find keywords that best associate with how you want to be feeling and what you want to be thinking at those certain elements in the race. So for example, and just one example, racing with packs. So what happens a lot of times with elite runners is they're in a pack, and they know sometimes in a certain race, a pack's going to take off, and they know wherever that pack takes off, they have to be strategic and fight that impulse to chase. If, for example, they're not going to follow that pack until it's 5 miles out from the finish. But if the pack leaves early, how do you stay? So they may have a cue word that says something to the extent of stay within you, or they may say keep your stride. And the other cue word that they may have may be as simple as go now. And that executes cognitively a set of behaviors built on confidence of, okay, now this is the part of the hill that I got to push, I got to press. And that's what's so unique about this is I don't think there's one blueprint or template for every runner. I think you have to take into account their personality, their past history. And I tell most runners, your starting point should be your best race you've ever run. That should be your starting point. You should be building from that. Instead of like, I want to hold that in reserve because that was so good, you know, and I haven't run like that in a while. I say put that out in front of you. Think of the ingredients. Think of everything you were thinking, feeling, and doing when you had your best 5K or half or full marathon, and then put those ingredients down and incorporate them into your goals for training and practice. And again, I'm oversimplifying the idea of having a good mental plan. What you're talking about is the idea of kind of how you self-talk through a race. I want to be a little bit more strategic and planful in that process.
Yeah.
I have some running buddies, and you know, I see that they struggle with their mental game for the racing. or even training. And I would go and I would say, hey, you know, have you ever thought about going and seeing, you know, a race psychologist or a sports psychologist? And their mindset is no, they feel like they're less of a runner or less of a person, or, you know, that they're mentally weak by going and seeing somebody like yourself. So I guess somebody listening to you that's had those, like, no, I'm a less of a runner, I'm a less of a person, or I'm weak-minded if I go see a sports psychologist, kind of talk to them like, hey, you know, this is, you know, the best in the world. Go see you. I mean, you've seen them. You've seen Olympians. So kind of touch on that and kind of help show the light more of what you do.
Blake's saying, sell your profession.
Sell your profession. I get that a lot. No, I don't need one. But it's more like it's a pride thing for them.
Yeah. I think if you listen to this, you're selling it already. So to me,
no. But you know, but here's a legitimate concern, right? There's a stigma about psychology to begin with. The very first day and my very first job when I finished my PhD, I was at Washington State University, so their new psychologist for athletics. So the first day in the big football stadium, they bring in all coaches. The very first coach I meet says, oh, you're our new shrink. And I go, no, coach, I'm your new stretch. He goes, oh, I like that. A year later, I meet with the head men's, all the men's, U.S. men's ski team, about 25 guys, and the head ski team coach introduced me, and I'm not going to say the word because I know it's a public podcast, but he introduced me as the team's new mind effer.
Oh.
Now, I've never been introduced like that before, but in that population, it made sense. So here's your concern. Athletes that think, I don't need to go there because I'm not having problems. Well, I know runners use chiropractors, nutritionists, they use physical therapists, massage therapists. I'll have athletes say to me, I don't feel like I really need to work with you because I'm pretty mentally strong. And my response back to the elite athlete is, well, are you physically strong? Well, what do you mean? Are you physically strong? Are you a strong physical athlete? Yeah, and they say yes. And then I say, do you lift weights? Do you work with a strength coach? Well, yeah, absolutely. So if you're telling me you're mentally strong, but you're not willing to work on that part of your performance, then you become amongst the group of athletes that they're okay with being pretty good. What I have found really unique in my career, and I think this is relevant for the podcast, is there's nothing better I love than the athlete who shows up self-referred, that comes in with notebook in hand and says, this is the part of my performance that I have to be masterful at. I need you to help me with that. And the same techniques and the tools that I use with elite Olympic level athletes or Division I athletes or professional athletes are the same tools that I'd give to any of my clients. The factor is who uses it the best and most. And I think that's really unique because I think some people are limited by their stigma and they see that, well, there's nothing wrong with, you know, there's nothing wrong with me, so why should I go see someone? But mental training in sports psychology is about taking people to elite status, to the best that they can be, and optimizing their own individual performance. And unless you sit across there and say, none of this is mental, then, you know, if none of it is mental to you, then probably don't need to work on it. But if you're sitting there saying, my best training has not always led to my best performance, then you need to get honest and figure out what do you need to work on. And on the flip side as well, and I want to be very clear, some people go to someone who they think is a sports psychologist because the person uses that title. You need to have your consumer interest to decide, is the person a licensed psychologist? If they are, what's their training in sports psychology? You know, how consistent are they? How much training did they get academically? How much supervised experience did they get? Because I could tell you that there's a lot of folks that are, I kind of call it the snake oil salespeople of what mental training is. Anyone can read a book. and there are good sports psych books. But to really make a commitment to the plan, you have to overcome kind of the challenge and the nervousness. You know, Blake, it's such a good question because people are like, well, and they come in my office and they look at these posters and they go, oh, okay. And all of a sudden I said, what'd you think? I had a beard and a pipe? and it kind of breaks down those barriers a little bit. And then typically our first session is just, what are your goals and what's your commitment to work on those goals? Wow. And then we start.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I need to talk to you after all this. I haven't put enough attention on this. We're going to do one quick sponsor plug here before we ask the next question. And so this episode of Running on Indie is brought to you by 361 Degrees Running Shoes. I've currently been running in the KGs and Meraki's pretty frequently. I think I might race my marathon in the Chasers. What are you thinking, Blake? What do you got going?
Well, I'm coming back from Boston, so I'm just kind of running in the Meraki's right now.
Yeah, KGs, I mean, that's a great shoe.
KGs occasionally for moderate runs, but, you know, yeah. I haven't really bust out the racing flats yet for anything. But, hey, you're doing the Monumental Mile.
Oh, yeah.
And you're going to be wearing the face shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's their new racing
shoe.
Yeah,
real lightweight flat.
Real lightweight racing flat.
See if I can run a mile. I mean... mentally, I am ready. After this podcast, I'm going for it.
Mentally, break four minutes. Just.
Oh yeah, I mean, if I tell myself I can do it, I can do it right. hey, so Dr. Carr, like, a majority of our audience are obviously distance runners. And a lot of them have run marathons. Can you describe, like, I know you've heard the term hitting the wall, and do you think that's just a physical thing, or is that something like that can be overcome to some degree, mentally as well?
Well, I think most marathon runners I've worked with, you don't train to just diet 20 miles. You train to finish 26.2 and finish strong. That's how you train. So I think part of there's a physiological process to that. And there's also a mental process. Again, every individual is unique. Every individual is different. I think we do a lot of self-imposed limitations, like the wall or the hills or a certain segment. So what I talk about is techniques like reframing. So instead of seeing yourself hit the wall, see that moment of the race be your strongest moment. See that moment of the race where your turnover and your stride is most effortless and most efficient. And start to create imagery and mental practice so that you're visualizing that segment of the race and how you're going to be strong in that moment. And the idea would be that you would use your mental training, which is goal setting, composure skills, visualization and concentration skills, and then pre-performance routines, you would really use to prepare for that moment in the race. Now, distance racing like marathons is a challenging physical event, and you run hundreds and hundreds of miles to be able to go out, line up with other runners, and run a PR in a marathon event. You have to work from a mental perspective to create a good pre-race routine so that the quote-unquote wall is not relevant. It's not a phrase. I worked 6 years with the Kansas City Royals baseball team, and baseball is very superstitious and it has all kinds of rituals. And one of the terms they use is a slump. And I think cognitively there are a lot of ball players that like to say they're in a slump because it kind of prepares them for the next bat at bat. But the reality in baseball, particularly at the professional level, if you have 100 at-bats and fail 70 times, you're making a lot of money and you're in the All-Star game.
Yeah.
But if you take every failed at-bat back to the dugout and keep ruminating on it, you may never get out of the minor leagues. So I don't like players to use slump or something like the wall. I say there is no wall that I visualize because my training is to not hit a wall. My training is to run through any wall, any challenge, any adversity, and run through it with confidence, composure, and focus. And that's how I prepare myself for my races. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, for your folks that listen to this, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi has written a book called Flow, the psychology of optimal experience. And he did all of his academic research studying kind of like optimal performance, not just in athletes, but in musicians, test pilots. So it's a really cool read. Huh. But in Csikszentmihalyi's work, he said people who get into flow on a regular basis, not just once in a while, but regularly, he said they have the ability to translate a potential threat into an enjoyable challenge. And I use that metaphor a lot with athletes because, you know, maybe they're going to run a race where they've never finished, or they're going to a course where they've added time. So they start to view that as a threat, that it might be another bad performance. And so what we'll do is we'll reframe so you have a mental routine that prepares you to go execute how you want to execute.
Wow. I've also, I know runners, and I've heard this before, like there was a study, I think if you put on like a smile on your face when you run, and I know runners that do this, is there benefits to that? Just like having like, just like trying to get into like that happy mindset by putting like a smile on your face. And is there something to that?
I don't know any data specifically to that, but absolutely. I would tell any athlete that I work with, if they view their distance race as an enjoyable experience, they're going to run faster than if they visualize it or see it as a painful experience. You have to embrace the suck. I think that's what I've heard other people say. You have to kind of embrace the challenge mentally, which may mean at the most demanding, challenging part of the race, you have a smile. But let's be very clear about something. In the sports psychology literature, there's what we call associative and disassociative strategies. So, for example, elite distance athletes incorporate an associative strategy, which means they are totally paying attention to their body, how they feel, how their breathing pattern is, how their arm movement is, how their stride is. They are totally engaged and aware of their body. More recreational or novice runners use a dissociative strategy. They want to listen to music. They want to be thinking of anything else but how bad their body feels. If you expect to be elite and continue to compete at a high level, you have to incorporate kind of an associative strategy, which means the acceptance of pain, the acceptance of discomfort, and then mentally, how do you manage that during the course of the race? And that's what I have so much admiration. You know, I've worked with athletes that have done, the Ironman in Kona, and just the ones that have gone and just kind of embraced the experience, it didn't really matter what their finish time. It was the fact that they went there and they made as much enjoyment out of it. And now they've established a place that they can kind of come back to and keep repeating. So I think there is a lot of truth to your mental preparation and your mental approach and your resilience factors that you can adjust to the conditions that exist in any kind of given race. You hear runners all the time, well, 60 degrees, it's going to be a breeze, perfect weather. That you don't control the weather. So what are you going to do when it's humid, 80s? And are you going to still see yourself as being successful and manage good performance? So the self-talk is a big piece of mental training for any athlete.
Or like Boston was this year, 40 degrees, 40 miles per hour winds, hail, wind, rain.
Yeah.
And if you read some of the interviews about how some of those top performers handled the distractions, they embrace it. They didn't see it as something like it was going to attribute to them having a bad performance. They were just going to make adjustments. They were going to use mental cues that kept them kind of determined and focused. And that's the powerful thing about, and you know, I've been very blessed now 30 years to be in this profession. And, you know, I've watched really cool moments like an athlete who's never won a World Cup go and have a great performance. I remember Darren Rolfs, who was on the U.S. ski team in 2001 in St. Anton in Austria at the men's Super G finals in the World Championships, half an hour before the race, just disconnected. And he just had a simple mental routine. He used his pre-race routine. He just kind of took himself from really a place that wasn't good into a really good place going out of the gates. And on that night, that race beat everybody. And a gold medal at a world championship is a pretty special moment when they raise your country's flag and play the national anthem. So those are, and that can happen for the person running their first marathon that gets under that 4 hour or 5 hour, whatever their time frame is, and feels that sense of accomplishment and satisfaction and doesn't compare it to anything else. And the fact this podcast is so important is because the running community, in my experience, for the most part, is a very supportive, engaged community. They support each other. They create the social environment. They help each other pick up if they didn't have a good race, they didn't have something. They're there to kind of help each other out. And I think that's a really valuable piece, that social support piece, because I think we feel better in ourselves when we know we've got that support.
Yeah, I agree. You know, even though sometimes we give each other shit sometimes running, in the end, everybody that runs a marathon or runs races knows what the other person's going through, whether they run their best time or they crash out. So, yeah, it is a really good support community. And plus, everybody knows how hard you have to work. Because the thing about running is not like baseball or basketball. Basketball, sometimes you can break your leg for a year and get back into it, and just you can kind of get back in the swing of things. But running, you miss. You got to train. You can't wing a marathon. You know, you got to put the miles in to get that marathon in. So
on elite level basketball, I think you can't wing it either, though.
I think you can wing it a little bit more than running a marathon. So I think Sports Illustrated said it was like the hardest thing to do in sports, run a marathon. So I do have another question, though, Dr. Carr. So Jesse's really faster than me, but if I wanted to beat him in the upcoming Monumental Mile, what kind of strategies would you tell me to do to overtake him, to have an advantage over him so I can beat him?
Or is there are there mental tricks to competing that you can implement on your competitors?
You know, here's the thing that I encourage, and this is my philosophy. You focus on the things you control as an athlete. And you don't control other runners. Now, unless they have full contact distance running, where you come in with shoulder pads and it's everything goes, it's the other runners are really irrelevant cues to your own performance. And so I'll use an example. I work with a fair number of high school athletes that are in swimming. And one of the common things they'll talk about is they don't swim well when they swim in a certain lane or against another swimmer. And I'll explore that. Why do you think that? Well, he or she's really fast and I've never beaten them. And then I'll ask him, I'll say, so do you swim with lane lines? Or is it just an open water across and back, first one wins? And they always look at me funny and they go, well, yeah, I have lane lines. I said, so what can you do to that other swimmer to disrupt their performance? Nothing. So any attention you give to another person who you have no control over, particularly competitively, is energy and focus you take away from yourself. And I like the idea of people saying, well, I want to dig inside. We know in terms of motivational theory, internal control, internal motivation, running for the love of running to challenge yourself to be faster, running to challenge yourself to overcome setbacks. That's the most intense, intrinsically valued motivation a runner can have, because how other runners do is not a controllable, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if you know you've had your best performance, it really doesn't make a difference where the other runners finish if you've got your goals accomplished. The competitive nature of human beings is I got to beat that guy or I got to be faster than her. I would say to most athletes I work with, that becomes more of a distraction and negative to your performance. And I get it. I mean, I'm in the highest level of sport. I get it that it's about competition. But it does not diminish the fact that if I want to win a gold medal at the Olympics, I need to learn how to control me to perform the best I can perform when the time comes. And in individual sports like running, swimming, those types of sports, you know, my daughter was a college gymnast and you know, you get in that competitive mode, but that's a very subjective sport. So it was the idea of what's your best vault? What's your best bars routine? Your goal is to hit that when it's your turn, compare it to nothing else. And so when she'd have meets where she'd win the event and or, you know, have a score that counted for a team, she was able to look inside it and feel good about her accomplishment and not compare it to anybody else. And it's a trap. I mean, Blake, that's kind of a trap because I put all my energy into Jesse and how I'm going to do against him. And the whole time you're doing that from a competitive nature, you're probably hurting yourself.
So my advantage is that he's thinking about me, and I don't think about him.
So I just need to go about my life and not give a crap what he
does. Hey, I get it from being a purely competitive situation. I get how that dynamic exists, and I get how it kind of directs your attention, or maybe it's the feeling of it that gets you to run another mile or do some other sprints at the end of a workout. I'm just saying from a motivational and a performance standpoint, it becomes more of a distraction than an enhancer.
Yeah, and I totally agree. I always tell people control the things that you can control and then try to let go of the things that you can't. So and other people's performance is something it's out of your control. It's not up to you.
Well, I do want to boast on you a little bit, Dr. Carr. So me and Jesse were over there having a beer at 317 Burger. We had a buddy meet us there, and we had mentioned who we were bringing on, and he knew you, and he said, oh, he's world-renowned. So you're known as world-renowned as a sports psychologist.
His dad sold you a car.
Yeah, his dad sold you a
Miller
car.
Auto or something.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he was bragging on you.
He was bragging on you.
Well, I used to say that, the definition of an expert is someone from out of town with slides. And I didn't bring my PowerPoint today, but, I was very privileged about 6 years ago to be the keynote speaker at the China National Sports Psychology Conference in Beijing.
Wow.
And it was a really cool experience, although I found that my jokes do not translate very well overseas.
In Mandarin.
I have the same problem. My jokes never translate.
His jokes don't translate in English, so.
Well, hey, I hope you were one of the reasons that ran off Paul George when you were working with the Pacers.
That was a good move. Let's not take any cheap shots here.
He's gone, man.
He works for the Pacers, though. We don't want to take any cheap shots at any Pacer
players. They're probably glad he's gone.
I love Victor Oladipo, always have. But anyway, I got another running question, kind of a two-parter real quick. I don't think we've touched on this, but I know runners, when they can't run, they go insane. So what are some techniques that people can use when they're injured and can't run to kind of get through that time? And then also someone else asked me, how about if you live with a runner or around a runner, and they're like your friend or family, and they're not running and they're going insane, how can you deal with that? How deal with them? Are there any techniques for that either way?
Well, the psychology of injury in athletics is really its own unique discipline. You could literally do an entire podcast just on that subject.
Oh, but man.
to briefly identify it, when an athlete is unable to compete at the level they want to compete training-wise, what you try to do is you try to give them helpful coping strategies. So common what I'll do with athletes is I have them journal so they have an outlet for the stress that's going on. I have them practice the relaxation exercise so they can do some mindfulness training so they can kind of slow down the thoughts. I have them incorporate their cross training that they're able to do and become more focused and embracing, whether it's in the pool, whether it's on a bike, when they're doing something as an alternative, depending on what their injury is or what they can do. And then I like to use kind of visualization so they can maybe every other night just lay down and visualize a nice run. If they're unable to run, they're basically getting that mental repetition, that mental routine. And now you feel a greater sense of control and proactive measures instead of feeling so out of control that an athlete often feels when they're injured. And this is a challenging topic because each individual and how they utilize their training and their racing as part of their personal development, I mean, all those things get a little clouded when you get injured.
Yeah. And what about the family members who have to deal with them? Be irritable.
We know for a fact that The individual who's injured is primarily responsible for how they're managing their anxiety, their stress related to the injury. The family system, the support system, whether that's a roommate, a partner, spouse, you know, someone who's in it, has to be able to kind of sit and listen to them, be a good social coping system. You don't have to give them answers. Just listen. And empathy is about saying that would be hard, not saying, well, yeah, that sucked. And remember the time I was hurt, because then the person's not going to feel hurt. They need to feel heard. And if a person feels heard and feels that support, then it's less likely to build up and they become more resilient and manage. I think as the other family, the other thing you can do to support is help direct them in healthy coping strategies. Hey, let's watch some racing, and then why don't you close your eyes and imagine how you felt when you finished the mini, or do some things like that that engage them in more of an optimistic thinking. But if a person is really struggling, and again, as a psychologist, I think I have to be really clear, there are individuals who can have kind of anxiety and mood issues that get exacerbated or triggered by an athletic injury. And at that point, that's where you really want to seek some professional help and get some support.
Yeah, I think that's like all we got for you, but this was incredible. I learned a lot that I've never even thought of. I think everybody that competes should go see a sports psychologist now. I think there's so much to benefit from it.
Well, now I have two psychologists I need to see. One for my wife says my mental state, and one for my running.
So maybe you can like bundle it together. I don't know.
I just
maybe
feel like I'm just a head case.
Work it all together. One. Do you have it? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
I got issues. There you go.
And is there anything like I know you came on here, and we want you to be able to plug anything like that you want, anything you want to plug, or any organizations or anything?
Well, one of the things that's been great about working at St. Vincent Sports Performance is that we have a really integrated support program. I mean, we have great, our athletic trainers and our athletic support staff, they travel with U.S. Track and Field. They go with Team USA at the World Cross Country Championships. So our athletic trainers, our physical therapists, our strength coaches work with elite athletes every single day. And so we really work as an integrated team at St. Vincent. The other psychologist that works with me, Casey, was a Division I athlete. She's a runner. She gets it. And we're really accessible to a lot of folks in the community. And I think that's the one thing that I've really liked about working with our physicians, our physical therapists, our strength coaches. We have registered dietitians who are sports nutritionists, both very active in running and cycling. So we're a very active organization. And I think the key is that if a runner feels like, I think I could do better with my mental preparation, I typically see athletes in my practice, you know, that are just working on this once every 4 to 6 weeks. So you're not doing something weekly, because if you're not willing to go do the exercises on your own, then you're not going to see much success. Like getting a workout plan. If you're not going to execute the workout training, it's unrealistic to go to the race and expect to do a big PR. So we kind of put the mental training less mystical and more applicable and practical for the individual that's using those strategies. So it's always great to come on to podcasts and work with different groups of athletes. And that's what's unique in our practice, is we work with really only athletes.
Yeah. And I was just at the, there was an open house for the downtown St. Vincent Center, and it that facility is incredible. I mean, there's such an, like you said, that integrated team, and like everything you need is there. And I know, do you work at the 86th one or downtown?
Well, St. Vincent Sports Performance now, we have two locations. We have one in Clay Terrace up in Carmel.
Yeah.
And it's on the north end of Clay Terrace. And our 86th Street location kind of closed down when we opened the downtown St.
Okay. I didn't know that. Sorry.
Yeah. So we actually have some of our physicians up at the St. Vincent Fisher's Hospital at exit 10 or 110.
Yeah.
But our practice is primarily at the Clay Terrace facility and at the downtown St. Vincent Center. And including, is we have a satellite office for our nutrition and sports psychology staff. I like those days, actually, when I'm down working with the Pacers, because I have my own office down on the Pacers training level.
Right there.
And And then I just jump on an elevator, go up to fifth floor to St. Vincent. So, yeah, it's an incredible facility, and we're more than glad to give folks tours and let them see our resources at either of those.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you pop in there one day and you could see a world-class athlete like at any time. It's incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the fun thing. We've had and posted on our Instagram, Jenny Simpson, some of the elite distance runners that come in and work with our staff. We do functional movement screening. We have the Alter G devices. I don't know if you guys know about the Alter G, but yeah, those are the treadmills where you can take the weight off. And you know, that's the great thing is we're talking about elite performance and helping individuals, whether they're an amateur distance runner or they're an elite competitor. We want to have the best resources from the mind, the body, the spirit. That's part of what working at St. Vincent's is about.
And your boy, Blake LaShawn Merritt, I saw on Instagram, was there the other day.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, he's from your, he went to your school, right?
He ran track, yes, for East Carolina University.
Yeah.
He only stayed like a year, well, not even a year, but yeah.
But that's your, he was just there, he was in town.
Awesome. So. Good stuff, so. Okay, well, we're going to do one last sponsor. But before I do the sponsor, this is way off subject, but Jesse, remember the Chappelle Show back in the day?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Remember that skit?
I don't know where this is going.
So we got headphones on. Y'all got headphones on. Uh-huh. Remember that skit?
I know where you're going with this.
Turn up your headphones. Turn up your headphones.
Turn it up. I can't hear.
Yeah.
I'm
so
deaf.
I don't know why, but the whole time. This has been on my mind since I put these headphones on. I've been listening to everything, but this has also been in the back of my mind.
I mean, for real, turn it up.
Yeah,
I'm deaf. I got it.
So, anyways, I don't know. I just had to get that out.
I'm with you.
It's been bugging.
Dr. Carr might not have seen that.
I just had that on, like my headphones.
Okay.
Anyway, we'd like to thank to our sponsor, 361 Degrees, powered by Quick Foam. Check out all the 361 Performance footwear at your local Runners Forum. We have 7 locations here in Indianapolis. Jesse works at the one in Bra Ripple across the street from Brian Wheaton's studio, Village Recording Studio in Bra Ripple.
That's where we are.
I'm the manager at the one downtown on Delaware Street. If you don't have a runner's form in your area, you can go to any of your local run specialty store and get you some 361 shoes. They're really great.
Yeah. So. And if you go to Blake's store, you can pop over to St. Vincent Sports.
Yes.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
I need to go over there and do a tour.
It's awesome.
Really cool.
The facility is awesome.
I need to walk over there because you're right up the road.
I
need to go over there.
Yeah. And then make sure to follow us on Instagram, on Twitter. You can obviously, if you found our podcast, we're on iTunes. Mm-hmm. It's all Running on Indy. Check out our website. You can listen through that as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Carr. You were a fantastic guest.
Yeah,
I learned so much.
I did too.
And I think this is going to be awesome for all the listeners. I think this is going to be a really great podcast. So
yeah, Jesse, I think we've got Instagram, Defining Sports Performance is our website, Defining Sports Performance. And I think that's also our Instagram,
awesome.
Facebook page.
I'm gonna follow
people
you.
Can track us, and we'll have all kinds of nutritional guidance. And every once in a while, we'll put in mental training tips. So it's great you have a program like this to share with your listeners. So good luck to everybody in their own mental pursuit of great running.
All right, we're gonna hold you on for one more second. We'll get the tie-in at the end where we all do our thing, our trademark. But I just gotta plug one more thing. I totally forgot about this. National Running Day, June 6th. We are doing a broadcast at the Red Room in Bra Ripple right after a group run that we're doing at the Runners Forum.
Free pizza
and beer at the Red Room. Post run, we're doing a 3.61 mile run because 361 is sponsoring the run. And then if you stop by, the unique thing is you can come share your story, whoever you are, come share a running story, whether it's motivational, inspirational, it could be funny. I like the funny ones, but inspirational is great too. Just want to come chat with us. You can get on the show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We want to see you guys come out and we want to talk to you. So.
And you can meet your favorite podcast host, Jesse and Blake, and all that jazz.
Yeah.
I had to say that.
You can meet your favorite podcast host, yes. Jesse.
Yes. Or no.
Anyway, all right. So
we're going to plug our next guest.
Oh yeah, next guest will be Camille Herron, legendary female ultra runner. So many records. She's incredible. Drinks a beer in the middle of a 100-miler.
She's got a couple world records.
Yeah, she's incredible. Good friend of mine, and she'll be on our next podcast. And just want to make sure we remind everybody to just keep running.